Good morning and welcome to Road Warrior Radio. You're tuned in live this Wednesday, November 29th, 2017 on the one and only Republic Broadcasting Network. And as always, thanks for coming along for the ride. A weird and wild ride it is. And it just gets weirder and wilder all the time. Today's best example probably comes from yesterday's slew of headlines about Elon Musk rebutting the latest ponderance or musing that he is, in fact, Satoshi Nakamoto, the creator of Bitcoin. And so the reason why I say this is the latest example is because it really is a story that is kind of lifted from the pages of comic books, stuff of comic books. One of the stories, The Guardian, there are a number of great stories on this yesterday, and I thought it was interesting that everyone wanted to make sure that you know that Elon Musk says that he is not Satoshi Nakamoto. So the whole story is, you know, as I said, sort of lifted from the pages of comic book lore. Elon Musk, a sort of Tony Stark-like character, part of what I call the Bruce Wayne Club, billionaire, 40-something wunderkind club. The story of Satoshi Nakamoto, so far unidentified, supposedly, and if you listen to a number of insiders, they speak as though they know who this character is. The latest rebuttal was in response to a Medium article that a former SpaceX intern wrote, and that's interesting, you know. I think just the whole story is bizarre when you consider, you know, some of the things that I've said about Bitcoin, for example. And for folks who don't know, I refer to Bitcoin as the Revelation 13 economy. When you understand how Bitcoin, blockchain, and AI sort of work together, you understand that blockchain is a distributed network. Bitcoin becomes a distributed network. And the information, the blockchain, and the Bitcoin economy is stored. It's housed on every device everywhere that uses it. They're leveraging your devices in Napster fashion, if you will. If you recall, the way Napster worked was basically it functioned as a distributed network. It was one of the early pioneering efforts of sort of an open source distributed network, music sharing, file sharing, we all had music on all of our devices, and we all agreed that we could have access to those different files. So, for example, I might have music on my desktop that you don't have and you want to listen to, and you may have music on your desktop that I don't have and may want to listen to. And so we agree that we can file share, essentially. So that gives a person access to someone else's, many someone else's machines, obviously. And Bitcoin functions in much the same way. So it's interesting. This gets into the issue of security. I'll talk more about that in a minute. But as I've said in the past, the two big myth busters, I suppose, when it comes to all things security as far as computing technology is concerned, the two big myth busters are the research study that Paul Ohm did, Broken Promises of Privacy, Responding to the Surprising Failure of Anonymization. And that was a research paper that he put out back in 2009 based on some very high-level, very publicly embarrassing examples of how there is no such thing as privacy. So Broken Promises of Privacy, Responding to the Surprising Failure of Anonymization, points out the fact that through the process of re-identification or de-anonymization, individuals hidden in anonymized databases can be re-identified or de-anonymized with astonishing ease. It's the combining of data sets that is integral to this concept. In the age of big data, that's what's happening. You'll notice, for example, that a number of websites or platforms, like Pandora, for instance, don't put as much effort these days into their website. It's a fantastic website, don't get me wrong. They were one of the first platforms to take full advantage of HTML5 and play their media differently instead of using Flash, using native HTML5 functionality. It's a great website, but they don't put as much effort into it as they do, say, their apps for your mobile devices. Why is that? Well, because they want to encourage you, obviously, to use your mobile devices. And so, you know, that's what's happening. Speaking of that, I'm always reminded of the article that ran late last year as a result of the election. Remember, and this should never fade from anyone's memory, the work that psychologist Michael Kaczynski has done in the world of mining social data. Speaking of nothing is private. The article was titled "The Data That Turned the World Upside Down." It was in Motherboard, January 28th, 2017, and also republished over at Stanford's Public Policy Program, "The Data That Turned the World Upside Down." Remember, in that article, they quoted Kaczynski as saying, "Our smartphone is a vast psychological questionnaire that we are constantly filling out, both consciously and unconsciously." Remember, that's what he said. And who is Michael Kaczynski? Well, this is what he figured out. They started modeling Facebook data to see if they could, you know more about you. And here's an excerpt from the article, a relevant excerpt. Kaczynski and his team tirelessly refined their models. In 2012, Kaczynski proved that on the basis of an average of 68 Facebook likes, this is not even posting anything. This is likes. Why are likes so important? And I've said it many times. Smart people know that the reason that you have a few buttons, the reason that you have a like button is not so that you can like things. And the reason that you got a few more buttons, a smiley face, a sad face, a heart, and you know those kinds of things, is not for your benefit. It's psychological profiling. You know, this system of likes was not quite proficient enough at identifying everyone accurately. So, you know, a few more buttons will help kind of narrow things down in certain spectrums. That's what that's all about. And it's as the adage goes these days, you know, if you haven't seen what James Corbett has been doing over at Corbett Report lately, as far as data being the new oil and, you know, how big oil conquered the world, why big oil conquered the world, what's next, what does that mean? You definitely need to go check that out. But he did a piece recently titled Data is the New Oil. So if data is the new oil, then you have to remember that adage that's been kicked around recently. If you're not paying for stuff on the web, then you are the product. Your data is the new oil. So if you're not paying for it, you are the product, which is why guys like Jaron Lanier have argued it'd be better to pay for something because you're actually being sort of raped and plundered by a process of degrees. Your data is being mined, harvested, and billions are being made on the marketing and the mining and the harvesting of your data. So for what it's worth, it's just a different perspective. Again, we get locked into these perspectives. We don't realize there are alternative perspectives because there's just this big monolithic push and it's all filled with assumptive tyranny. Nope, the data, we have queried the data and it says that a one-button society is best for you. Everyone should wear white smocks and we should all operate this way. We should all work this many hours. And there might be a certain delineation. Folks that go to STEM schools, well, you know, they should work a little bit. The rest should not work and receive a UBI, Universal Basic Income, which if you've read any of the studies recently in throughout the 20th century, for example, back into the 30s even, you know that that's destructive. And as I have said before, there's a reason they call the projects, because it was a psychological experiment to see how people would behave. Aaron and Melissa Dykes did a great piece on that not too long ago. And they've included that subject matter in a few videos. Anyway, back to Kaczynski. Michael Kaczynski and his team tirelessly refined their models. In 2012, Kaczynski proved that on the basis of an average of 68 likes, Facebook likes, by a user, it was possible to predict their skin color with 95% accuracy, their sexual orientation with 88% accuracy, and their affiliation to the Democratic or Republican Party, 85%. But it didn't stop there. Intelligence, religious affiliation, as well as alcohol, cigarette, and drug use could be determined. From the data, it was even possible to deduce whether someone's parents were divorced. But wait, it gets creepier. The strength of their modeling was illustrated by how well it could predict a subject's answers. Predict a subject's answers. Kaczynski continued to work on the model incessantly. Before long, he was able to evaluate a person better than the average work colleague merely on the basis of 10 Facebook likes. 10. 70 likes were enough to outdo what a person's friends knew. 150, what their parents knew. And 300 likes, what their partner knew. More likes could even surpass what a person thought they knew about themselves. On the day that Kaczynski published these findings, he received two phone calls, the threat of a lawsuit and a job offer, both from Facebook. So, like I said, the modeling is the reason for the changes in Facebook. You are the data. You are the product. And again, I refer you back to the remark that the guy who created this system, Michael Kaczynski, made with regard to devices. Why does Pandora clearly pour more effort, energy, resources into the development of their smart device apps than their website? If you're like me, I'd rather pull up the website if I have to, because you have, as a friend of mine once said, you have 10 fingers. They work better than a thumb or a single finger. It's easier to type. You have more functionality. You have a mouse, but you also have those other 10 input devices at the ends of your arms, your hands. So, bigger screen, arguably better functionality, but that's not in the interest of these companies that mine your data, harvest your data, is it? The smart devices are equipped with a vast array of hundreds of sensors that are constantly monitoring your everything. Your every move, your every location, your every everything. Your altitude, your precise latitudinal and longitudinal coordinates. You know, a number of stories were just published, last week about how Android as a platform, yes, it has been tracking you even when geolocation is turned off. Oops. Who doesn't know that? I mean, that's been common knowledge from the beginning, basically. The devices are always on, essentially, even when they're off. I mean, I mention it all the time. I need to post that somewhere. Shepard Smith did a piece on Fox News, even though he doesn't remember it, back in 2008, talking about how the FBI can listen to your phone even when it's turned off. I don't know about you, but that seems kind of creepy to me. So is there any security? Nah, not really. You have to remember, who built the system? Who built the internet? It was a military project, the ARPANET. Remember, and you know, for that matter, Tim Berners-Lee at CERN, you know, guys like Tim Berners-Lee and Richard Dawkins and all these guys, they're all occult Satanists. So where did the internet come from? And people are naive enough to think that there aren't back doors that can be exploited for certain people's advantage and benefit, and to the detriment and disadvantage of others? You've got to be kidding me. Are you really that naive? So Kaczynski said, our smartphone is a vast psychological questionnaire that we are constantly filling out, both consciously and unconsciously, mostly unconsciously, obviously. So you always have to think of that when it comes to security and privacy. So back to Paul Ohm's paper, Broken Promises of Privacy, responding to the surprising failure of anonymization. That's the other big one. The article about Kaczynski, not Ted, but Michael, different spelling, little joke there. The other piece is, of course, that odd interview back in 2009, also titled Another Czar in the Obama White House. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we come back. Stick around, more right after this break.
Ladies and gentlemen, J.R. Moore here. As most of you know, my regular listeners, I offer energy cleaners for sale at my website. If you don't have a clue what I'm talking about, go to my website, thelibertyman.com, educate yourself about these marvelous healing devices. We focus on pain mitigation and getting a great night's sleep. Arthritis pain, joint pain, back pain, doesn't matter. Keep in mind, I offer for me to you personally a 30-day money-back guarantee. That's what I do. Energy cleaners, $285, should be included to American zip codes. You can educate yourself all about the energy cleaner right there at my website, the patent application, the wonderful testimonials. Be sure and check out the factory-made fitted mattress pads to go with the energy cleaner. Now, I offer for me to you personally a 30-day money-back guarantee. That's what I do. I have a toll-free order line, or you can order it right at my website at thelibertyman.com. The toll-free order line is 800-592-9543. I say again, 800-592-9543. Thank you.
Do you know there is an ongoing war right here in America? Are you aware that U.S. citizens have been classified as enemies of the state since 1933? Have you recognized that our entire government is really a vast network of interlocking corporations engaged in commerce? Look up Title 28, Section 3002. Tune in to In Defense of Humanity on Saturday nights at 7 p.m. Central Time. Find out what's really going on and learn how to protect yourself and your family as flesh and blood men and women living in a corporate reality.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team.
Getting back to, kind of the subject at hand, it wasn't security, but you always have to remember there is no security. There is no privacy on the internet. There is no such thing. And as one of the greatest talks that was ever given on the subject was Andrew Rajay at the Digital Privacy Forum back in 2011 that aired on C-SPAN. Rajay said, he cited Paul Ohm's research paper, Broken Promises of Privacy, responding to the surprising failure of anonymization. But Andrew Rajay summed it up very well when he said that usefulness and privacy are inversely proportionate. So if your data is useful, it's not private. And really that, I think, is the operative concept. And what you need to understand as far as that's concerned is you really don't have much of a say in the proportionality. That's kind of the point when you when you read through the article, The Data That Turned the World Upside Down, originally written by two reporters from Zurich-based Das Magazine in published originally back in December of last year, and that was kind of where the firestorm was sparked about Alexander James Ashburner Nix and his remarks, the wild goose chase that started after Cambridge Analytica, and how the mining of data to elect a president was used, among other things. And of course, when we talk about the election, we have to include Greg Palast's expose on the vote rigging system. Chris Kobach's interstate cross-check system that purged over a million people from the voter rolls. That wasn't quite enough to tip the possibly not enough to tip the elections, but then again, possibly was based on where that happened. So that's an interesting story too, but I digress. Again, one of the best summarizations of the subject was Andrew Rajay saying that data is either if it's useful, it's not private. They're inversely proportionate. And you have to understand that it's the social networks that are determining the usefulness and the corresponding privacy or lack thereof. And so obviously, hopefully, you realize that rhetorically speaking, there is no privacy in social either. Law enforcement agencies talk routinely about – we see the news stories where within minutes these days, certainly hours, within 24 hours, all of social media has been mined when someone has done something. Their entire life on the web, so to speak, has been mined. That always finds its way out, and trolls are doing that. A lot of folks are doing that in the early moments after something happens, before social profiles and things go dark or taken down or whatever. So this really isn't – it shouldn't come as that much of a surprise to folks. What Michael Kaczynski has done in wiring that data up to profile people, though, is pretty astonishing. Anyway – hopefully that all makes sense. But getting back to the article, so the two big, just to finish that thought, the two big pieces when it comes to privacy are the Broken Promises of Privacy article by Paul Ohm, and then Warren Olney's broadcast back on May 29, 2009, that Friday that the Obama Cybersecurity Initiative was launched and announced, where he just happened to have four of the greatest cybersecurity experts on the planet on his obscure public radio broadcast. Another czar at the Obama White House. It was an interesting piece, and as I mentioned before, I posted something back in 2015 on Facebook about doxing when the subject arises, because you got to think about that too. That happens quite a bit. Anyway, we'll conclude this thought and move on when we come back. Stick around, more after this break.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Many people write us about their experience with Extendivite. Allow me to read you one of them from Amazon.com. I was diagnosed with high blood pressure. I was a little bit alarmed, as I have always been in good health. I started this regime as soon as it arrived, and I have noted that the heaviness in my chest is gone and the pressure headaches I have been having are lessened. I am hoping to see greater results as time progresses, as I am an avid non-user of pharmaceuticals and avoid them at all cost if possible. This was, I think, a great alternative to heart medication. Not that I am a doctor, and for some, there is no choice, but again, for someone like me, I am so far pleased with the results. Tell us your story. Get Extendivite today. Call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
For the past 14 years, it's been my privilege to host the National Intel Report on RBN, to offer a platform to interview exceptional guests, to provoke critical thought, and examine evidence, whether real, fake, or somewhere in between, and allow our audience to call in and participate with your input and questions, in order to help us all reach an educated decision and arrive at our own truth. Our world has changed. It's now been turned on its head. Real is now considered fake, and mainstream fake is now pushed as real, rather than any clear thinking, consensus, or rationale.
Those few remaining beacons of light, the ones still shining through the mainstream media lies, propaganda, and deception, are being viciously attacked at every level through attempts at censorship, threatening advertisers, jailing hosts, and even killing journalists brave enough to speak the truth to you. We are in a war for our very freedom and existence, and through these despicable acts, freedom haters, collectivists, and communitarians have shown they will stop at nothing to blot out these last few beacons of light. Truth is becoming increasingly more difficult to unmask, just as the term unmasking itself is spoken by those usually anonymous sources. They promote their lies, wishing to mask the truths by ignoring it, vilifying it, or conspiratorializing it into a black hole abyss.
Regrettably, RBN has reached the tipping point, and through internal audit and actuarial review, it has now been determined that the only life raft of survival to this network is to go the way of PBS, that being audience-supported. Like a cornered animal, the left with veracity is pulling out all the stops with every effort to effectively blacken our beacon forever. Help us, folks. Help yourselves. Don't let our light stop shining. Our motto has always been, because you can handle the truth. It's time to review your budget, folks. If you want the truth to keep flowing through RBN, go to republicbroadcasting.org and become a regular monthly donor of 30, 40, 50, or 100 or more a month and ensure you keep the truth flowing.
Give you a clip here in a second of a great piece that CNBC put together on this subject. The title of the article: Elon Musk denies he is Bitcoin creator Satoshi Nakamoto. And this was one of the numerous articles that swirled yesterday, which is interesting. Again, you know, to me, this is sort of a leading piece. It's propaganda. All of these stories combine to make sure that everyone in every little niche understands that Elon Musk is not Bitcoin creator Satoshi Nakamoto. So, you know, it's that cartoonish story. You know, Tony Stark is not the creator of this digital currency that doesn't exist unless people acknowledge that it exists, to borrow conceptually from Jaron Lanier. But just to finish the security point, because I really don't think it can be overstated. I know I'm being redundant, but you have, I mentioned Michael Kaczynski's the paper that studied Kaczynski's work and his mining of Facebook data in particular, social data and Facebook in particular. But that article is titled "The Data That Turned the World Upside Down." Then going back in time to 2009, August, you have Broken Promises of Privacy responding to the surprising failure of anonymization, where Paul Ohm proves, using three very public, very embarrassing examples of how seemingly anonymized data, data that had the personally identifiable information scrubbed, that stuff that we hear is so important. As long as we don't have our names, our social, our date of birth, and those kinds of things in there, then we're safe. No personally identifiable information, PII. Oops, that's a fallacy. Paul Ohm proved it very conclusively. The other piece, that article, or excuse me, the interview, another czar at the Obama White House. Again, that was the day that the Obama White House announced its cybersecurity initiative. And Warren only just happened to have four of the greatest cybersecurity experts on the planet on his obscure public radio broadcast: James Lewis, Paul Light, John Arquilla, and Tom Kellerman. And you'll recall that was the broadcast. Things like this were said. Tom Kellerman said, and he is, you know, former senior risk management specialist, World Bank security team, among other things. He said the privacy debate is moot because the U.S. government is no longer, he said it no longer has a monopoly on being Big Brother. Any hacker with automated attack tools, and by the way, didn't I mention yesterday that there are a number of AI and machine learning libraries out in open source? I mean, go search GitHub for these libraries. Go to TensorFlow.org if you're not familiar and look at just one example. And Google and Facebook and all of these monoliths are creating and contributing to these libraries. Anyone can download them. They're available. They're open source. It's really simple. It's literally a click or two away. If you use GitHub, you have it installed on your server, your local machine, you can pull a copy in with a single command. Very easy, right? So that's frightening. So back to Tom Kellerman's remarks, speaking of any hacker with automated attack tools and any government, 108 of which, Kellerman said, have cyber attack capabilities. Who are the greatest? Of course, the United States and the state of Israel, which is not the same as the biblical Israel. It is what I like to think of as is not real, but whatever. So all of these folks, any hacker with automated attack tools and any government, 108 of which have cyber attack capabilities, Kellerman said at that time, that's almost 10 years ago now, and all major criminal syndicates of the world have the capacity to be your big brother, in other words, to steal and mine your data. And then this was my favorite quote from that talk. It's forever emblazoned in my mind. John Arquilla responding to either Kellerman or Lewis, Jim Lewis, who made a remark about how the bank heists these days, the physical heists are usually $6,000 or less. The perpetrators almost always get caught. The virtual heists are usually $1 million or more, and the perpetrators virtually never get caught. In response, Warren Only, the host, says, wow, you know, that makes you think about safe places and things like firewalls. You know, what do you say about that? And John Arquilla's response is, I think the biggest problem is that we have a Maginot Line mentality. We believe in things like firewalls. Yeah, we do believe in things like firewalls. We've been encouraged to believe in things like firewalls. But he continued and said, my master hacker friends, and as you and I know, if I said on public radio or anywhere publicly, my master hacker friends say, black SUVs with guys in black suits and black sunglasses would pull up so fast, it'd make my head spin. But, you know, John Arquilla, being the Rand Corporation author, professor of defense analysis at Naval Postgraduate School, et cetera, you know, he gets a pass on that stuff. The guy who authored The Advent of Net War, a document published by Rand back in 1996 that everyone should read because it's as relevant or more relevant today than it ever was in 1996. But I digress. So John Arquilla said, I think the biggest problem is that we have a Maginot Line mentality. We believe in things like firewalls. And my master hacker friends say there are no such things as firewalls. They only recognize what they already know, whatever that means, and really, really good hackers get right through them like you'd walk right through an open room, not through a door, a room, as in it doesn't exist. This is what I'm talking about when I say if you think that there are not vulnerabilities that are exploited day in and day out in this architecture that was created by bad guys for bad guys, you're beyond naive. There is no such thing as privacy. So John Arquilla says the biggest problem we have is a Maginot Line mentality. We believe in things like firewalls. His master hacker friends say there are no such thing as firewalls. They only recognize what they already know. Really, really good hackers get right through them like you'd walk right through an open room, like nothing, not acknowledging anything. So I think those are the big points when it comes to security and privacy. It's a myth. So if you understand how Bitcoin works, you understand that basically it's an invitation into all of your devices everywhere. And this is why we see, you know, what I would call prostitutes for Bitcoin prostituting themselves and pushing Bitcoin, why we see a significant drawdown in currency, specious in nature as it may be. All of the currencies of the world that the central banks have promulgated and inflicted on the people of the world are specious. It was never supposed to be that way. A brief aside on that, I always think of John Adams' words, and we all should understand his words. We're so ignorant these days, and we think we're so smart. How did Orwell put it? Every generation thinks itself smarter than the generation before and wiser than the generation after, I think is how he put it. But again, I digress. So John Adams, the way that he put it, all the perplexities, confusions, and distresses in America arise not from defects in their constitution or confederation, not from a want of honor or virtue, so much as from a downright ignorance of the nature of coin, credit, and circulation. In this day and age, who can distinguish between coin, credit, and circulation? Can you distinguish between specious currency and credit? They're indistinguishable at this point because the currency is a debt-based instrument. But I digress. So who can distinguish in America articulately between coin, credit, and circulation? John Adams believed that all the perplexities, confusions, and distress in America arose from the ignorance of the nature of those three, coin, credit, and circulation. So do we learn about that? Do we learn about those and the distinction between the three? Nope. But again, I digress. So Bitcoin is not just a currency. It's an invitation for malfeasance. And really, if you understand the architecture, it's a way for bad guys to hide their transactions while they spy on yours. That's what it is in simple terms. That's one of the aspects of Bitcoin. It's a way to regulate markets, control markets in an unprecedented fashion, this sort of cryptocurrency, which is the term cryptocurrency is a misnomer. It's encrypted for you, but not for everyone. So the story, again, getting back to the original point and the story, Elon Musk denies he is Bitcoin creator Satoshi Nakamoto. If you follow the story, hopefully you understand what I mean when I say it's a story steeped in cartoonish rhetoric. Elon Musk, a sort of Tony Stark figure, Bitcoin, you know, Satoshi Nakamoto. Every time I hear Satoshi Nakamoto, honestly, I always think, who is Kaiser Soze? That's what my brain always thinks. Who is Kaiser Soze? And the mystical and intriguing story, the tale that Kevin Spacey's character weaves, you know, verbal kint while he's there being interrogated essentially by Chaz Palminteri. Anyway, that's what I always think of. So I want to get to this clip. We're running out of time. Again, the CNBC piece, Elon Musk denies he is Bitcoin creator Satoshi Nakamoto. Listen to this on the subject of Bitcoin. Go ahead, please.
One of the biggest mysteries in the technology world is the identity of Satoshi Nakamoto, the computer programmer who invented the digital currency Bitcoin. That's because Satoshi Nakamoto is a pseudonym. It may be the name of one person or the name of a group. But for over 9 years now of Bitcoin's existence, no one has figured out who or what Nakamoto really is. Beyond solving a long-standing mystery, what sort of impact would uncovering Nakamoto's identity actually have? To answer that question, let's start at the beginning. In 2008, Satoshi Nakamoto published a 9-page white paper containing the first ever mention of Bitcoin, calling it a peer-to-peer electronic cash system. At this point, Bitcoin was just an idea on paper. But in 2009, Nakamoto put the concept to test, releasing the cryptocurrency's first software. Nakamoto was active those first few years, writing in forums, sending emails, and working with other developers and coders to improve the program. That all changed in 2011, when Nakamoto essentially vanished. No more forum entries, no more emails. And in all that time, nobody, not even close collaborators, ever met the founder in person. But here's the thing. Whoever it is, they didn't walk away empty-handed. Nakamoto is estimated to have 1 million bitcoins, which, as of today, is worth over $5 billion. So why did Nakamoto just disappear?
Well, there are two competing theories. There's the good Satoshi hypothesis, which holds that Satoshi really wanted to let Bitcoin go and become its own thing without him. The other hypothesis is that Satoshi really just saw Bitcoin taking off and wanted to keep his privacy.
That's Matt Green, a cryptocurrency professor at Johns Hopkins University. He says the latter hypothesis is more likely. And as evidence, he points to the story of Dorian Nakamoto, a Japanese-American who, in 2014, was incorrectly identified as being the inventor of Bitcoin.
Just a couple of years ago, Newsweek identified a man named Dorian Satoshi Nakamoto, who isn't Satoshi Nakamoto, but they thought he was. And reporters descended on his house and tore apart his life.
Would you mind speaking to us for a moment?
No.
I have nothing to do with Bitcoin. I just believe that somebody put that fictitious name in there.
I don't know what this is all about.
So I think there's a pretty good case to be made that the last thing you want to do in your life is be identified as the creator of Bitcoin.
But for some people, being in the limelight is exactly what they want. Take Craig Wright. He's a former Australian academic who, in 2016, told the BBC on camera that he could prove he was the founder of Bitcoin.
So you're going to show me that Satoshi Nakamoto is you?
Yes.
It didn't quite work out that way. Security researcher Dan Kaminsky concluded Wright's claim was intentional scammery.
For someone like Craig Stephen Wright, it may have been, you know, beneficial in his mind to claim that, you know, authority. You're able to speak at conferences, you know, garner a lot of support.
Ben Yu is a cryptocurrency investor living in San Francisco. He thinks Nakamoto is Nick Szabo, an American computer scientist.
There is strong evidence pointing to certain people who may be Satoshi Nakamoto, but ultimately nothing definitively conclusive.
So why do people keep searching? It comes down to money and politics. Bitcoin has a finite supply. There are only 21 million that can ever be mined. Nakamoto is assumed to have 1 million of them, which amounts to about 5% of the entire cryptocurrency. So let's put that in perspective. Take gold. The U.S. government holds the most gold reserves of anyone in the world at about 8,000 tons. The estimated total gold in the world is 187,000 tons. So the U.S. has about 4.3% of the world's total supply. That means Nakamoto may have a bigger stake in Bitcoin than the entire U.S. government has in gold. And if Nakamoto were to unload those Bitcoins quickly, the value of the crypto could tank.
The thing about Bitcoin is if you control a million of them, you have the ability to flood the market at any point. Think of them as rare baseball cards, right? They're valuable because they're rare. If somebody could dump hundreds or thousands of Mickey Mantle trading cards, rare ones, onto the market, they wouldn't be worth so much anymore. So that's kind of the danger with Satoshi.
But some people don't think the impact would be long-lasting.
Ultimately, like every form of currency or money, Bitcoin's value is predicated on its trust. And Bitcoin has already been deemed extremely trustworthy by a lot of people. There's about $3 billion of value being traded in trading volume every day, and the market cap is already over $70 billion. So even if Satoshi did crash the price with, you know, a few billion dollars of Bitcoin being sold, ultimately it would rebound back, I believe, as the trust is already there from many other parties.
Then there's the influence Nakamoto could have on politics.
So Bitcoin has been having a number of very complicated political kind of arguments between different factions. And a lot of these different factions have invoked Satoshi Nakamoto as kind of their guiding figure. They say Satoshi would have wanted this, or Satoshi would have wanted that. That's easy to do because Satoshi's not there, and so we don't actually know what Satoshi would have wanted.
I think the community may actually benefit if, you know, Satoshi did choose to come back and become a spiritual leader who could provide guidance and reconcile the community towards consensus.
For now, though, it doesn't seem like Satoshi Nakamoto is interested in coming forward. Anonymity provides protection, privacy, and peace. Three things that likely appeal to the owner of 1 million bitcoins. But is that really such a bad thing? With the havoc it could wreak on the price of Bitcoin and internal politics, it may be better off that Nakamoto, whoever that is, remain anonymous and inactive indefinitely. But that won't stop people from wondering.
So there you go. That's a great piece by CNBC on the controversy surrounding Bitcoin. The title of that video at the bottom of the article I mentioned, the article titled Elon Musk Denies He is Bitcoin Creator Satoshi Nakamoto. The article, the video at the bottom is titled Bitcoin's Origin Story Remains Shrouded in Mystery. Here's Why It Matters. And that gives you some background and some insight into why it matters. And think about what we're talking about. I mean, only in a society, only in a world, a post-truth world where we're less concerned about facts and reality, more concerned about a persuasive argument, a cartoonish comic book story, could something like this take root. Who is Satoshi Nakamoto? No one still knows. 10 years later, essentially, almost 10 years later, and the whole conversation shrouded in mystery. You heard, you know, politics are obviously a factor in this system. It is the cryptocurrency system itself is built on a system again that was architected by bad guys for bad guys. The internet was the ARPANET originally. And so the architects that built this system didn't build it for you and I in the same fashion that Facebook is not built for your convenience. Nothing these days is built for your convenience. Have you noticed how devices, hardware and software are they seem to be becoming less convenient as technology advances? The opposite of what you would expect, because that's verification. It's verified evidence. They're not built for you. You are the product. So the question, who is Satoshi Nakamoto? Nearly 10 years have gone by. Obviously no answer. Doesn't it strike you as odd if, and by the way, just to correct the numbers, Cointelegraph was one of the outlets that had a story on this yesterday as well, titled Elon Musk, I Am Not Bitcoin Inventor Satoshi Nakamoto. And correcting the numbers at the end, does it really matter? Here's an excerpt from that article. While Bitcoin has grown organically and drawn millions of users into its fold without the active involvement of Satoshi, questions will always remain about his identity. Nonetheless, the development of the Bitcoin protocol has proceeded apace without Satoshi, given the talented developers who work on Bitcoin and significant community support. However, if Satoshi is still alive and if he still holds his private keys, he is believed to own about 1 million Bitcoins. So what? With Bitcoin having just breached the $10,000 level, that gives Satoshi a net worth on paper of $10 billion. Think about that. You don't think there's an interest there? You don't think there's a story there? Continuing. Given that many believe Satoshi no longer has control over the coins, if he ever decided to sell his bitcoins, the price of bitcoins might plunge. Given that Satoshi has remained out of the limelight for so long, it does seem likely that he values his privacy more than the billions that his bitcoins are worth. Then again, with Bitcoin's epic bull run, nobody knows at what point the mysterious founder might change his mind. So, again, shrouded in mystery. Do you understand how volatile this entire marketplace becomes based on those simple little revelations? A market shrouded in mystery, a system shrouded in mystery built on top of a system built on intrigue and deception and not for your benefit. I mean, it's just laughable. It really cracks me up. You know, I have no interest. I am completely averse to cryptocurrencies. And I really am suspicious of folks who are prostituting themselves and can't market this stuff enough. In the piece, the clip that we played, you heard U.S. gold reserves. That's a complete fallacy. There have been a number of efforts to audit the U.S. government's gold reserves that have been stolen, essentially through the Federal Reserve System, which is not federal and obviously not reserve, as proven by the fact that we can never seem to get an accurate accounting of the gold reserves that should exist. Do they? Well, we're not sure. And a trustworthy system, you know, we heard that soundbite. Trustworthiness of this system was surreptitiously predicated on transactions that were all black market. It was created surreptitiously created by Silk Road and other black markets. Again, do any research into Bitcoin in particular and cryptocurrencies, and how can you not come away with suspicions to a level that cause an aversion to the entire system? I just don't understand it. This is only possible to me in a post-truth world, a comic book world. You know? It's utterly absurd. That's my two cents on the matter. So we'll move on to other stories of the day, so to speak. When we come back, there's no shortage of fodder, that's for sure. I thought it was interesting, the Cointelegraph article had a caricature of Elon Musk pulling off a mask, supposedly of Satoshi Nakamoto, with the finger over the lips, you know, the Masonic sign, dead men tell no tales, we don't talk about this, we're sworn to secrecy. Thought that was interesting too. Stick around, we'll be right back after the short break. Second hour coming up.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.